I want to express appreciation to the hiking crew here. And I believe Holden has always been a place for me which in some ways is a safe place to both get close to people and to the river and to the wildflowers and maybe even to the deer. And so there are some very immediate and memorable exchanges that you carry away with you and think about and remember. And I'm very grateful that I've had an opportunity to be here again and to go with you all. And I will be thinking about sorting out the memories and the encounters. And incorporating them into the next stage of the journey. I'm particularly grateful for the level of the kind of conversation around the scripture. Because if we are going to have Bible study that leads to consensus and nurtures the community, we're going to have Bible study where everybody in the group talks to each other rather than somebody tries to establish the final answers for the whole group, because we are not a time and place anymore where answers that come down from the balcony seem as trustworthy. So many of the answers that come down from above don't work. We need to be more testy and testing of the answers lying around. And I think communities of people who are loyal to the grace that they have received are very safe places to test the language and to find new insight. I'm also rather sad to be leaving, so that's just the way it is. But there is there will be joy from the sadness, but it's a little sad too. Okay, Jesus in the shadow. Is he a joker? Matthew 15:21-28, and there's a parallel in Mark 7, but we're going to focus on Matthew 15:21-28. And so we have another specimen text. The word shadow is simply a way of posing a problem that many of the conventional things we say about Jesus don't seem to jive very well with some of the stories that the early Christians saved about Jesus. And if you just kind of take these stories relatively literally, just take the plain reading of the story, you're going to come up with a less... I come up, when I just say, well, what does this story say? I come up with a more... with a Jesus who is much more full of surprises and whom I don't figure out as much, whom I don't seem to have as much of a handle on as the Jesus that I put up on, you know, the Jesus pictures I had as a kid. And so there is a charisma, a mystery, a provokingness, a irony, a tenderness, which is amazing me. And so I'm basically trying to lay the problem in your lap so that you will kind of keep going back and forth between what you hear somebody say about Jesus and what some of these stories are like. And maybe if we commute enough, we'll be able to get a dialogue that is fruitful. It is my conviction. The dialogue in the community of faith under the Spirit with the Scriptures can provide us with moral examples, can provide us with moral problems that will get us to think more clearly about moral situations. I happen to believe that God does not that even when God wants us to have childlike qualities, God does not always treat us like children. Sometimes he gives us questions rather than answers. Sometimes God gives us problems rather than solutions, and gets us drawn into the struggle rather than herds us into a pipeline. And I also think that sometimes the Spirit uses text so that we will awaken to the fact that a couple thousand years of the Spirit interpreting the Scriptures should have given the community of faith one or two new ideas about what God is about in different circumstances. And so maybe some of the stories in the Scripture really are there to get us to figure out that we shouldn't do things that way anymore. I'm sure that the stories about stoning people to death in Leviticus have got to be a message to not do it. They've got to be there to remind us that we oughtn't to do things like that anymore. And if God doesn't provide a ram in the thicket like he did with the sacrifice of Isaac, we should be smart enough now not to do it. Okay? So you see what I'm saying. Don't give up on the Bible, but give up on the notion that everything in the Bible ought to be not thought about is like a putting a nickel in the slot machine. It just runs by automatically. The things that are in the Bible, you got to think about. They're fuel for spirit wrestling. They aren't. You see what I'm getting at? For goodness sakes, give God and the Spirit a little bit of credit for knowing what kind of people we are. Just don't assume that they're a computer. I mean, I grant you computers are wonderful. I'm even struggling to learn how to use mine. And I know how to drive a car, and I wouldn't give away the washing machine. But give God a little bit of credit for being at least something more human than a computer. Okay, you're all there. What am I carrying coals to Newcastle? But anyhow, we have a wonderful text. We have an absolutely wonderful text, and a couple of flags about this text. One is Matthew's not Luke. Luke gets the women out of the closet, and Matthew is not overly interested in stories of women. Matthew is a more traditional first century type, although the Middle East and other parts of the world are still traditional in this sense. Gender is tied to function. And people of certain gender get certain jobs and not others. And that's the way it was. I don't know that that was a... I don't think that's a good way for us to allocate work, but I've been one of the blessings of Holden. I have seen some wonderful father and child pictures at Holden. Fathers who are spending time tending their preschool children. And I think it's just wonderful. And I feel a bit deprived because I kept having to go out to work all the time. But the moral of the story is women are not on stage very much. Women do not get in the stories. They obviously were there. They obviously had an enormous, some of them, not all of them, some of them had an enormous amount of power in their households. But they're not on stage. So when you see a woman in a text like this, boom, that's a special character. Two, most of Jesus' preaching was within a 20-mile diameter. Those of you who know the Northfield area, I tell my students it's something like Jesus spent most of his time commuting between Northfield and Dundas and Faribault, and not much further. Once in a while, he hiked to Minneapolis or something like that. Went up to Jerusalem two or three times, and managed to get himself in a mess in Jerusalem. But by and large, it was very small turf. So to have Jesus, you know, you almost think they went off to Tyre and Sidon like they were going to Holden Village. If they can get off stage, then they can get a little bit rest and quiet and recover from the burnout and be ready to come back again. But red flag, this is Tyre and Sidon. This isn't Jerusalem. And there's just no indication that Jesus was rushing around. I mean, quite the opposite from Paul. Paul gets on his high horse and takes these journeys all over the place and writes letters even as far as Rome. But there's no indication that Jesus was the least bit antsy about this whole thing. And he just hung around his home turf and did his thing. I mean, so it's kind of a surprise to have him in Tyre and Sidon. Okay? All right. Now, this is a text which I would like a woman to read. All right, Elaine?
Matthew
15:21.
And Jesus went away from there and withdrew to the district of Tyre and Sidon. And behold, a Canaanite woman from that region came out and cried, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, son of David. My daughter is severely possessed by a demon." But he did not answer her a word. And his disciples came and begged him, saying, "Send her away, for she is crying after us." He answered, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." But she came and knelt before him, saying, "Lord, help me." And he answered, "It is not fair to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." She said, "Yes, Lord. Yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table." Then Jesus answered her, "O woman, great is your faith. Be it done to you as you desire." And her daughter was healed instantly.
I'm going to give you about a minute or so to think about the text just yourself. Get into the text by yourself. I think that women have most to gain and lose with this text. And I have been learning, probably the hard way, that I should listen more carefully to what the women in my life are saying. So I'm going to suggest, wasn't my idea either, I mean I got it from somebody else, but I think it was a very good one. I'm going to suggest that those of you who have male gender stay out of the discussion for the first 8-10 minutes, and I'm going to try to do the same, and I'm going to leave this discussion to the women in the group, because this is a story in which The driving force of this text is the woman. And there are three exchanges, a nice little triplet. The woman's initiative and Jesus' response, woman response, woman response. Okay, the floor is open for inside question, comment from women.
One of the first reactions when I've dealt with this text with other people is this makes Jesus sound very nasty. Jesus doesn't normally sound nasty when he talks to people, but you hear that first comment to her, just hearing the words, it doesn't sound very nice.
Okay, that really, I will make a parenthetical comment because that explains the word joker. In other words, one theory, he's either got to be insulting or he's got to be teasing her in a very sharp, persnickety way. Okay, thank you, Bertha. All right, it's yours again. End of parenthesis.
Well, it's, as usual, I guess, it's, he knows something, it seems like, about this woman that I don't know. That's what it seems like to me. Well, I don't know, but it just seems like a strange way to respond to someone unless he knows. Because first she says something to him, and she's suffering, and he doesn't answer her. Which is what I do to my kids when I think that they're, you know, they're playing some game and that kind of stuff. You know, I'll kind of wait before I just think that's odd. He must know some more about her.
Or is he just wondering what to say? Is he just giving it time because he's not quite sure how to answer her?
I wonder if the disciples were relieved when he said, I was sent home for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. I mean, was he trying to get response from them as well?
But because we know he didn't believe that.
Yeah, well, you know, at least he came to not believe it.
How do you? I can't restrain myself. How do you know that?
Well, when he gets before he ends his journey, he tells his disciples, "You're supposed to go, go, go," and he spreads the circle where they're supposed to go further than the lost. So that's why I think he knew it. Carol said maybe he knew it later, so that sounds interesting.
I mean, we see a change right in this text of some kind of, whether he knew it all along or whether he came to it in the midst of this action, but I think it's very interesting. She has a request and they have a request. She has a request, heal my daughter. They have a request, send her away because she's bothering us. And the first thing out of Jesus' mouth must have given them a little relief. I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. I wonder if he was waiting for some kind of response from the men there. He didn't get it.
So maybe he's learning as he goes along. Maybe he's learning from the woman as much as, you know, maybe he's learning here too what his mission is. I'm not too sure that he knew it all along. You know, I think he could be learning from her. Mm-hmm. I'm intrigued by what you said about your kids. What is it that finally makes you pay attention to them?
Well, I do pay attention, but
I mean, I've done the same thing, so I'm just trying to explore a little bit. What is it that makes us finally listen, you know, when they beg and...
Yeah, I'll have to think of some, you know, some specific examples.
Yeah, it's an interesting comment.
I think that with at least with one of them, if they start in on something that they're like, they're trying to be manipulative and stuff, and I'm pretty sure that if I don't say anything, then they'll keep on going, and they either dig the hole deeper or they finally tell you the truth. Or, I mean, sometimes they just get it straight without me saying anything. If I don't start responding to whatever it is they're making up,
uh-huh.
That probably sounds weird, but
no,
I thought of it when, you know, because here comes this lady, and I wouldn't think he'd know her, and she's all in pain, and then he doesn't answer her. And I think, what's the matter? You know, why?
I love that, because what it triggered in me was that my 17-year-old daughter will say something to me, and she knows when I'm not listening. And she'll finally say, "Listen to me, mother." You know, and that gets my attention. And sometimes myself in a group, I will feel like I have gone unheard.
Yes.
And unless I feel very assertive saying, "This is what I am saying," or say it in another way somehow, oh, okay. I mean, I have to say it in a certain volume and a certain kind of conviction. And looking back at it, it's sort of like, okay, saying it again to try to get your attention. Mm-hmm. You know, and then she says something and, oh, wow. You know, it's like, it's almost like Jesus is learning from her.
I also think that this text is rather like yesterday's in that Jesus, there's an agenda here. He's been sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. There, that's the agenda, and then here's this interruption, which forces Jesus to consider some other action, and bring the disciples in on that consideration. I think is one of the reasons why. But anyway, his response, his first response, is not his last response. That is, there's a growing here. His first response is sort of no, but he, unlike most of us, or at least myself, is not dug into a position. But when she comes back, she's a gutsy woman, when she comes back and gives him a reason, desperate as it may be, he changes along with that situation. I think that's an incredible model, both for our tenacity and for our ability. Our tenacity when it comes to seeking what we want and what we know is healthy, and like Jesus, being able to listen and readjust our response.
Well, I just really identify with this woman. You call her gutsy, and again, for a woman to come like this, it just simply wouldn't have been done. Now, yesterday I was given the explanation that she was an entertainer and those kind of ladies did gutsier things than the rest of the women. But this one isn't. This is just a person, apparently. And she's a Canaanite. And here she comes up, and I identify with her because her goal is to get her daughter healed.
And wouldn't she fight for
her? Those of us who have kids, or any of us who know kids, this is what we do, down through history, no matter what culture says.
We might not fight for ourselves or stand up for ourselves, but if our kid needs something, you'd have courage to go for it.
Yeah. I wonder, because it also amazes me. I mean, without any interpretation at all, it's that when he does respond to her, with the part where he says it's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs, whatever that means, it sounds like a reprimand to me. And that, under normal circumstances, that would be it. You know, I mean, I would have to go talk to somebody else and regroup. But maybe for your kids, you would.
That's the only time I did.
I agree.
I'm wondering if it's all that complicated, particularly in terms of Jesus' response. If you play this set of verses out, like a play, like it were really there. What you don't get here is the timing. And what you don't get is, as you mentioned the other day, the kind of inflection of the role. And you can see it all happening fairly quickly. You know, we talk about it as though it were spread out over this enormous amount of time, but if you think about it as it probably really played out, she comes to him, he might have even paused just briefly. And it wouldn't take his disciples very long to get on the bandwagon and say, let's get this show on the road here. And for him to turn to them with that response about where he came, what he came to do, as if, hey guys. And in an instant, the whole process spins out. I mean, I think we've given Jesus a whole lot of complexity here that may not be, I mean, if you look at it as a normal. I like the irony that you talked about the other day, and that response to them is, can take that irony on very well, and that gives her an opening. I think the timing is an issue, and the inflection is an issue, and it changes the whole text. I had never thought about that way until you mentioned that the other day, but I don't read it at all today like I might have yesterday.
Yeah.
Is this a test for her?
No, I don't think so.
Maybe it's a test for Jesus.
Just flipping to the mark.
Why does it have to be a test for anyone?
Because it's so ironic.
Life is a test.
The Mark account talks about how at this point Jesus was trying to get away and he wanted to escape notice. And I said, I mean, I think he was probably a little bit irritated that this person comes to find him if this is the same encounter. And probably that's why the more curt kind of answer first. You know, and also the disciples protecting and say, no, let's just get rid of this shouting person. Mm-hmm.
But is it possible that the curt response was not to the woman, but to the disciples?
Well, I don't think it's to the disciples, but it may be for in their hearing for a good reason.
So he turns everything into a lesson. This is just a real important lesson.
And the dogs aren't like garbage dogs, you know. They're like little puppies that are in the house.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Are you learning anything, Vern?
I'm interested to hear what the guys are. I mean, it must be just frustrating. So I'll get out to not be speaking.
Do you think it's should we open it up?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Open it up.
Can I ask one question? How insulting is the word dogs in that time?
Yeah.
It's puppies.
One thing that I remember, unfortunately, Mark Edwards, who has he has an absolutely encyclopedic mind for historical detail, and he's on his way to Holden Lake. But I think it's a kind of affectionate term for dog. I mean, I think it's doggy, you know. It's a little bit of the diminutive of dog. I do think, regardless of how, I don't think calling people dogs is very complimentary in the ancient world, whichever way you look at it. And I think in this case, the dilemma of putting dogs, I mean, it's a perfectly reasonable point, you know. I mean, which one of you, if you have a limited amount of food, are you going to feed the kid or the dog? Well, it's the only reasonable thing is to feed your kid, isn't that?
But
even fathers would do that.
Yeah, but what does that have to do with the question?
I've never figured out.
I want to hear what Al was saying before we jump.
Well, it's just two things. I see that his response is an insult to her. Number one. Number two, and I mean, you know, you raise the point of, is he a joker? I don't think it's funny.
All right, if you don't think he's a joker, then it is very insulting. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Yeah.
Very insulting. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So also is her response, then. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you put it in that kind of setting, I think you've changed the whole complexity. There's nothing more fun than to have someone feed a line and be able to come back. What I would have said was a wonderful put down that, you know, that she really deserved, and I'm not convinced that that's the way it was being fed. I think it was done with some of the irony that you're talking about, some of the sarcasm almost that you're talking about. And she takes what she knows would be the common line and turns around and bests it one. Mm-hmm. Which is absolutely a marvelous interchange.
Yeah.
But I think that the key to it is also in who are the Canaanites?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when you're talking about I was sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, Is Jesus excluding or including the Canaanites in that phrase?
Because
I think Jesus is including at that point. I think Jesus is not saying to his disciples, you know, a line they would cheer for.
How about I sort of knocked Roy off the track a while back, so I want.
Well, I'm still trying to figure out verses 26 and 27. I think Jesus was really out for lunch here. He must have had something else on his mind, totally and completely. And just starts talking about children's food and dogs. You can hear this woman's daughter was dying. And,
not dying.
Yeah, tormented.
Yeah.
Tormented.
But not dying.
Oh, okay.
Well, pretty sick.
Pretty, yeah. I mean, this was a high need on the part of this woman. And the daughter, and then Jesus comes with some... Oh, I've had conversations with people like this. They come in with something, and I thought, we weren't even talking about that.
Isn't the children's bread healing? That seems a logical metaphor. Can you see the children's bread as healing? And
if that's how a demon was healed, then that's fine.
Mm-hmm. So to you, it seems like he's just talking totally out of the conversation.
I've never figured out these two verses. That's been never figured them out.
We got two people that have been waiting in line, so push yourself in.
Well, I can imagine two things. One is he's away because he's been feeling a lot of the demand of people for healing and comfort and all of this sort of thing. So there's a personal side. But the other thing which strikes me, which makes this sort of a remarkable model, and there are not too many other examples, but this is certainly a powerful one. Because he's listening to somebody who is certainly lower on the social status, both woman and either Syrophoenician or Canaanite or whatever. And he's changing something which at least I can imagine for men, this is a very important thing. Who would say, my purpose? Who changes one's purpose? Particularly if you're the leader, if you're the head of the household, if you're the head of whatever the role of men was then or even now. And to actually turn around and say, you know, I was sent for this, and to listen to someone else and change your mind. So my sense of the dogs and that is that's a little bit of defensiveness. That's protecting, you know, that's protecting Jesus from this demand, but maybe also from the possibility. This is a significant change. So I guess for me it's potentially a very significant change of direction, and what our first inclination, certainly our first inclination to believe that Jesus was on top of it the whole time, knew what he was doing, to pull out irony and all those things, I think it's even possible he was a little defensive and this was a significant change. And that's a different Jesus. But one I like. This is a lot more like me. Mm-hmm.
What I hear you saying, and I think I feel that strongly, is that he, at least as I interpreted, he treated her rudely, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And then she came back and said, this is what I'm feeling. And he was mature enough to recognize that and appreciate what he was there for and what she needed, and was able to change.
Well, and he didn't best her. I mean,
no,
clearly,
right.
If there's anybody in any of these arguments who could have figured out the comeback to what she said, I think Jesus would have got it. He's been doing it all over the place,
right.
Marvelously.
I think the story really demonstrates that she bested him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
And he takes it.
Talk about modeling for the disciples.
Yeah.
I was thinking you were going to say, talk about modeling for Ben.
That too. You can see this as a kind of an ethnic cartoon, you know, that Jesus is standing outside of the Israelite health clinic, and the Syrophoenician or Canaanite health clinic is closed, and she comes up, and they've both got supposedly the same, you know, something the same to offer, and he says, well, do I switch loyalties here? I think her response to Bob, I thought you had an interesting idea there, but I thought her response indicates that she knows very well that there's a little bit of playing around with taking what belongs to the house of Israel and dispersing it to others who are somehow not worthy to receive it, and that's why her response is, but even the dogs get upset. But she's clearly very sharp. So she gets an A+ in my humor book.
You bet.
Yeah.
I agree
with that. I want to take it in the same direction, although a little differently. I think that her character is established right at the beginning for Jesus, because he knows what kind of a person she is immediately, simply by the way she comes on. And then we don't know that, and I think by the end of the story, the wonderful line with which she comes back a second time to him, that terrific response, yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat from the crumbs that fall from the master's table, a marvelous response, and it tells us that she has a certain kind of chutzpah.
Yeah.
And now I'll speak from a person who teaches in the classroom, and if I have a classroom of 40 kids, you can sense right away that there are certain students you can kid with. That's right. And those are the ones you have the most fun with.
Absolutely.
And exchanges with.
Absolutely.
And you will dare to say things to them. And I'm just thinking of a situation last spring with a certain student, which I would never dare to say to anybody else, which would be a terrible insult. But with that student that carried on it, I don't know where that conversation is going to go when I start out. But I know it's going to be fun, and it's going to go someplace. And everyone at the end there's a creativity in this story. I love Carol's remark about that there's this agenda, we teachers, you know, are going down a certain road, and then somebody pops up with some kind of a remark, and then we'll run with that. But I don't know where it's going to go, and it opens up a wonderful gift at the end of the story.
Well,
I want to identify with, go ahead, after you.
I'm just interested because I tend to agree with that sense, but I'm also disturbed by the fact that there's several people who have suggested that the woman's issue was so great that she may not have been, even though she was capable of the comeback and all of that, and it could be the one to joke with, that the issue was too serious for that kind of interplay. I mean, I kind of got that notion back here that...
No, I don't think so. I think it can be both.
Okay.
She's lived with that daughter for many years.
Yeah.
I really identify with your remark about how a needy or a persistent or both or a clever student can say, I've spent my whole life being sidetracked from where I was going by somebody that could somehow or another trap me into a conversation when I hadn't planned on it, you know. And I must say that I think this business of Jesus trying to stay out of trouble isn't any different. How many of you have answering machines, may I ask? Well, there are a few of you, even if you're but all my kids have answering machines. I can't believe it. But this business of trying to, there are times when you need to stay, well, you can't take call all the time, can you? Well, at least after internship. I realize that if you're on internship, you're supposed to be able to take call night and day, but after that, you've got to go off duty sometime or other. And I think I think there's a deep-seated, to tie this into the theme, there is a rather deep-seated dehumanizing of Jesus. We just don't act like he was flesh and blood and male gender, or, you know, we act like he's a picture. You know, and I really think it would be helpful for the church if we began to take seriously the humanity of Jesus. Because if you take, I mean, this is the long-term agenda, if you take seriously, from when you do Christology from below, if you take seriously the humanity of Jesus, then you're going to have to take seriously how interested God is in how human natural life works. You know, and maybe being working for God is not a matter of being a hero, but is a matter of finding the places where God's at work in our lives. The other comment I'll kind of let go again. The other comment I want to make is about the process. You see, Jesus must have gotten something from Mary. We did the Magnificat last week. Again, the notion that God somehow implanted a beeper in Jesus so he knew what God knew all the time doesn't strike me as very human. It seems much more likely if God worked like God works, that Jesus got strengths from his mother and was backed into some kinds of tasks. And maybe even, I'm not at all sure that Jesus volunteered to be crucified. I think he was. He decided he couldn't run away from this. But I take the Gethsemane prayer very seriously to say, I wish this hadn't happened. You know, so this is not a guy with a martyr complex that is waiting, sticking himself out there so he can make a big splash. You know, that's what I'm, so maybe we need to take serious, another way to say this, maybe we should take seriously Pentecost. Maybe we should take seriously that there are some things about the whole process that kind of don't become clear until the Spirit begins to use the community to reflect on what happened. And that just as God needed Israel to give birth to the history behind Jesus, to birth this situation, God used the followers of Jesus after Jesus to draw out the implication. You see how I'm thinking? I'm thinking a process in which Spirit works that is more inclusive and less focused on Jesus as some kind of demigod. I'm not saying that Jesus isn't the focus of the picture and the point at which the process comes to full life, but I am suggesting that maybe God isn't simply working through solitary individuals. That the God process is a more complex. Hang on. Persistent woman, isn't she? Okay, now I'm done. I've had my intermission. I'm going to shut up again.
Is that a problem?
Oh, I wish I could take you to class with me, Al. I just wish I could take you to class with me. I could use you. How much do you hire out for?
What's the historic of the lost sheep of the house of Israel at that time?
You know the answer to that question. Don't ask me.
I really do question.
What, huh?
I really did question that.
No, I don't. I'm not even sure I hear your question.
We Jesus uses this phrase. I was sent. You are saying.
Oh, okay? Oh, oh.
If Jesus.
Okay. Yeah. What you said before.
What was the?
I think your suggestion is very plausible. I had never thought of it that way. You've given me a problem. I got to go home and look it up, but I don't have any books with me.
Yeah.
Because I have just read this really as meaning, this is straight Judaism, and Jesus really didn't think he had a mission to Tyre and Sidon. Mm-hmm. You know, this is I think the Jewish. The historic community of Judaism had an intense sense of vocation. It had a sense that it ought to shape up before it kind of expands. I mean, it's a perfect example of be a God-centered community. And then the nations will come to you, not go to the nations. They had no objections to people converting to Judaism, but they thought it ought to happen because they manifested the God life, not go out and pull them, you know.
Which is.
And the Christians came out as they developed in the Greco-Roman world, they adopted the exact opposite attitude. But I think Jesus was probably more Jewish than Christian. That's what I'm thinking.
The Jewish would never have heard the lost sheep of the house of Israel.
Well, now there is imagery. There is sheep imagery. We've got to remember that for the Jews, shepherd reminds you of David. Shepherd is the term for your political leaders. So that the lost sheep are the people who don't have good leaders.
But are you also suggesting the other tribes?
Yeah.
The dispersion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I don't think Tyre and Sidon are Samaria, are they?
They're further away.
You see, I would agree with you on Samaria. But I don't. I think just geographically, Tyre and Sidon is. This is upping the ante. We got a whole other problem when we get up into Syria than we have when we're just in Samaria.
And Mark calls her a Greek.
Hmm?
And Mark calls her a Greek.
Syrophoenician.
Well, he calls her Greek.
Both.
As well as
uses both.
Of course, Matthew wouldn't want to call her that, but that would spoil the point, huh?
Mm-hmm. I'm looking down back to the Mark. When he responds, he doesn't talk about the lost sheep. He says, let the children be fed first, mm-hmm. for it's not fair to take the children's food and give. And if, you know, this, I can see where maybe his thinking was, I'm only here to deal with, you know, I'm not supposed to spread out to other people. But I sense that then she sees, you know, the abundance or the possibility maybe he can just as well spread out a little bit, because she said, sir, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. It's not the master's table, it's the children's crumbs. And any of us who have, just the other day we were sitting next to little Thomas and we got through it. You know, there were a lot. And I'm wondering if this woman hasn't, you know, somehow is prodding Jesus, or is the opening, maybe what you were talking about, you know, God uses people, helping Jesus understand it's okay to expand your response.
Does the irony extend also back to what goes before it in both the Matthew and Mark account? Is a whole teaching about it's not what goes into the mouth that defiles, but it's what comes out. And so it's kind of like, here's the test, put your money where your mouth is, act decently towards this woman. Otherwise, all your teaching is proven false. And I think maybe there's some fun with that. Wow, here we have it. What shall we say to this? Shall we say no, or it's all right to pick up the crumbs from the floor? And then she's, the daughter's healed.
She's calling forth.
It's already radical for Jesus to play back and forth with her call. Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, in a sense, that's an editorial, that'd have to be an editorial thing, because I don't think the time element is supposed to be, is necessarily the same. But in both Matthew and Mark accounts, it's that teaching about defilement that it's setting.